Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week are Christy Lemire and Tim Cogshell. We'll hear their opinions of Guy Ritchie's new action thriller, Wrath of Man, starring Jason Statham. Billy Crystal stars in, directs, and co-wrote Here Today, co-starring Tiffany Haddish. The action comedy, The Paper Tigers, features middle-aged former kung fu prodigies looking to regain their edge. And actor David Oyelowo directs his first feature film, the fantasy adventure The Waterman. Lonnie Chavis and Rosario Dawson star. Our John Horn also interviews Oyelowo about the experience of directing his first movie. We're listening to music from the soundtrack of the Oscar-winning Nomadland. It's Film Week, right after NPR News on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. I'm joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide, Cinegods.com as well, and Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Our first film of the week is the action thriller Wrath of Man, directed by Guy Ritchie. He's one of five credited screenwriters on the movie, which stars Jason Statham, Holt Mill McCallany, and Josh Hartnett. Christy, please start us with Wrath of Man.
Oh, this is so much fun. It's just a dirty piece of fun, and I enjoyed it. Guy Ritchie and Jason Statham reunite. Of course, Statham was, he got his break with Guy Ritchie with Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. And it's been a while since they've worked together, but they're an excellent team. Jason Statham here plays this very mysterious figure who takes a job with a security company for an armored car fleet. And he's kind of low-key, but since he's a Jason Statham character, you know there's a lot more going on under the surface there. And it is very much a Guy Ritchie movie in that it is extremely violent and darkly funny. And you have these characters who are hyperverbal in ways that maybe you don't expect. But as the revenge plot kicks into place and the pieces fit together as to who Statham is and what he's doing there and what he's after, it kind of operates in a different vibe, a different key. I don't mean to say that it's not understated per se, because Guy Ritchie does not make understated films, but it's not like the kinetic, like wham bang mix of textures and pacing and slow-mo and sped up. It's not that kind of frenzied filmmaking. It's a much more straightforward kind of LA heist action thriller, a little sleeker, but it's a tremendous cast. Jeffrey Donovan, Scott Eastwood, Andy Garcia, Raul Castillo. And it's just fun.
How is the location of filming? You mentioned it's set in Los Angeles, Christy, and I was wondering if this might have been done pre-pandemic, or did they figure ways of working around it? Could you tell?
It looks pre-pandemic, but a lot of it takes place in like industrial sections of Los Angeles, like just to the east of downtown, or some of it takes place along Wilshire Boulevard and Koreatown. So it's places that are kind of desolate a lot of the time, where you can maybe make a film shoot work. But that didn't even occur to me as I was watching it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it didn't, there's no indication of a pandemic. Wrath of Man, Tim, what'd you think of Guy Ritchie's new film?
Yeah, the only pandemic in this movie is Jason Statham. he's the killer in this movie. There's a lot to give away in this rather overly long sort of high body count, serpentine, revenge, mystery, heist, thriller. It's all of that stuff. So rather than giving any of that away, I'll just talk about Guy Ritchie films. And there are Guy Ritchie films, as Christy says, you know, when he's not making Sherlock Holmes films, Guy Ritchie makes these things called Guy Ritchie films. He even makes Sherlock Holmes films like Guy Ritchie films, if you think about it. And it does start way back there with Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels. That was the first one. Jason's in that, but not the lead. And then the best of them is, of course, Snatch. And then Jason was the star of a film that he made called Revolver back in 2005, and Gerard Butler and Rock and Roller. So in this canon of Guy Ritchie films, I would put this one in at number two now. So for me now, it's Snatch, this, and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Now, the thing about this movie is it has all this sort of like Guy Ritchie stuff that's in it, which is it means that it's about guns and dialogue, not fighting. So those of you who love Jason Statham in a good fight movie, he's not doing that in this. This is guns and talking. And like in all Guy Ritchie films, the women don't really have much to do. Usually they're in distress. Sometimes there are bullet stops for the men. That's about true here, too. Nevertheless, once this thing sort of weaves its way through the story that it's telling you, it hits every one of those genres nice and hard, and it pops. And it's going to go in at number two with my Guy Ritchie films.
Wow. Wrath of Man, rated R. What's your number one, Tim?
Snatch.
All right. Yeah. Guy Ritchie, director, co-wrote the screenplay. Jason Statham starring in Wrath of Man, rated R. It's in wide release. The comedy here today is directed by, co-written by, and stars Billy Crystal with Tiffany Haddish. Alan Zweibel is the co-author of the screenplay with Crystal. It's based on Zweibel's short story, The Prize. Here today, Tim.
We've had a few of these in the last year or two. Of course, Anthony Hopkins just won an Academy Award for playing the father, about an older man slipping into dementia. Lance Hendrickson was in a Viggo Mortensen movie about the same thing at the end of last year. And then we have this one, which is about the same thing. We learn very quickly in this movie that Billy Crystal is this older gentleman who's been diagnosed with a sort of dementia that's creeping upon him. He's this sort of very important comedy writer. He's well known, and he's sort of like a he's not the Lorne Michaels, but he's like the right-hand man to a Lorne Michaels type on a show that's just like Saturday Night Live, where he sort of shepherds these writers. He gets one in a raffle to be the lunch date, Larry, I know you know what this is like, of a person who wins him in a raffle. Tiffany Haddish, she didn't really win him. Her boyfriend won him. She doesn't even know who he is, but she takes the lunch anyway because it's a free meal. So we have these two comedians, Tiffany Haddish and Billy Crystal, and for a good chunk of this movie, they're doing what they do, just being funny, physical comedy. She's apparently allergic to shellfish. All kind of stuff is going on. And then we have this backstory of what this man is going through as he sort of slips into dementia and all that he wants to get straight before it all kind of goes away. Look, it can be sort of saccharine and syrupy and silly. And when they break aside off to do these little comedy routines, it kind of breaks the movie up a little bit. But I got to tell you, I just didn't care. I love seeing Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish. And when they mix it up, man, they really mix it up. And it was just good in that way. A lighter touch on the same subject matter.
Here today, Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish star. Christy, what'd you think?
Oh, man, I'm going to be mean now because this is maybe one of the worst movies I've ever seen. It's just terrible. It's just awkward and stiff and never funny. And Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish have very, very little chemistry. I mean, individually, so enormously likable, but the writing here is just so awkward and no one ever feels like a real human being. And the friendship between them or whatever it is, it's this like amorphous, undefinable thing. It never clicks on any level. She just completely gives up her entire fledgling music career out of nowhere to help him. Like, things are on the rise for her. She's a singer, and just out of nowhere, she just drops it all to be with him. It makes zero sense. The comedy within the movie is always flat. It's so bad. It's so painfully unfunny that I almost feel like they intentionally made it bad. Like, you know how comedy in movies about comedians, it's sometimes kind of terrible. And that's the case here too. Like, all the sketches are just, they're just terrible, or they're a slog to sit through. And so you have between Tiffany Haddish and then the flashbacks to Billy Crystal's wife, who the love of his life, who has died. They're both these like manic pixie dream girl figures in his life who are like whimsical and spontaneous and never feel like fully fleshed out human beings. They only exist to serve him, as everyone in this film does. Everyone's constantly telling him how hilarious he is and what a legend he is. And it's just strenuously well-intentioned. It's so mawkish. It's so melodramatic. It is uncomfortable, physically uncomfortable and cringe-inducing to sit through.
Okay, Tim, I must have you back on for just a quick rebuttal.
I'm going to have to push back against that. Not a whole lot, but some, particularly about those sketches. When they're doing the sort of fake Saturday Night Live stuff, Billy Crystal has this thing where he has this actor on the show, and this actor puts the emphasis on all words in the wrong place. And Billy, it drives him crazy, his character crazy, when he's doing this stuff. And Tiffany Haddish, I'm sorry, Christy, she and Billy Crystal, they had a little banter thing going where they're taking these little pot shots at each other, but they're just, you know, right off. And it's just, it's just so funny. But it's this sort of lighthearted, funny. And Billy Crystal will always just be an endearing figure in my life. I can't help it. I just love me some Billy Crystal.
All right. Here today, so you hear the completely disparate reviews of Tim and Christy, and you can make your pick. Here today is in wide release. Billy Crystal also directed and co-wrote the screenplay with Alan Zweibel. It's rated PG-13. The Paper Tigers, an action comedy that stars Elaine Oi, Ron Yuan, and Michael Shannon Jenkins. The film is written and directed by Bao Tran. Tim, tell us about The Paper Tigers, please.
Well, I love this one, too. This is a real solid You Killed My Master kung fu butt kicker is what this is, except for it's funny. In a Karate Kid meets, you know, Rumble in the Bronx, Jackie Chan kind of way. And I love the way it opens. So during the credit sequence, we see these kids, young kids, 1986, 10, 12 years old. And they have this master, and he's training them in the garage, and they're doing all that stuff they do with you stand in the hawk position and all this stuff. And then we see them as they start videotaping when they get a VHS camera as they become older. And he's teaching them all the sort of classic kung fu things. Never use your kung fu in anger. Always use your kung fu to defend others. But one of them, whose name is Danny Eight Hands, which has just got to be the most wicked name of a kung fu, Danny Eight Hands. And you know what? He's fast. He really is. They grow up, something happens, and it breaks them apart. And they haven't seen their master in 20, or each other in 25 years. And somebody killed their master. So, you know, you get your kung fu movie. They have to come back together, but, you're, you know, they're a little, one's kind of fat, one's kind of slow. Danny Eight Hands is like Danny One and a Half Hands. It's one of those. And they have to figure out who killed their master and avenge him and find themselves in their kung fu again in the process. The movie has that same problem. There are literally only two women in this movie. One of them is just a bit player. The other one is the angry wife. I'd rather they not put any women in the movie at all than to use the only woman in the movie in the way that she's used in this movie. But other than that, yeah, kung fu butt kicker.
The Paper Tigers, written and directed by Kwok Bao Tran. The film stars Elaine Oi, Ron Yuan, and Michael Shannon Jenkins. Rated PG-13. It's in select theaters, but also available to see at home on several on-demand platforms. The fantasy adventure film The Waterman is directed by David Oyelowo, written by Emma Needle. Lonnie Chavis stars along with Rosario Dawson and Oyelowo himself. Christy, please start us on The Waterman.
This is also David Oyelowo's feature directorial debut. And he is borrowing quite a bit from Steven Spielberg. But if you're going to borrow, like, do it from the master, right? That's an excellent source to take from. And there's such a winning kind of earnestness to it that I feel like he comes by it honestly in the approach he's taking here. It is this fantasy about a kid, maybe about 13 years old, played by Lonnie Chavis, who is extremely likable. Got a great natural, authentic way about him. And his mom, played by Rosario Dawson, is very sick. She is dying of cancer. And he hears some legend about someone named the Waterman, who figured out the key to cheating death and who has magical healing powers. And so he sets out on this adventure into the forest of Oregon, where he and his family have just moved recently, to go and find this guy. Along the way, he teams up with this young woman who is a little bit older, who is a teenage runaway, and together they kind of scrap their way through to find this guy. David Oyelowo plays his father, who goes on the run to try to track him down in the forest. And there's this wonderful balance of the reality of being a kid and feeling just really lost and torn up about a situation you can do nothing about when your mother is really sick. And then the hope that something like this can carry you through. And there's a fantastic way of introducing the magical elements of the story within this realistic setting. It's got kind of an analog feel to it, even though it takes place in the present day. There's an E.T. lunchbox in the very beginning of it. That's a nice little tip of the hat to Spielberg. So it definitely has that kind of like 80s kind of Goonies, like kids on the run adventure, the kind of thing that kids these days would never do because we'd be able to track them down through their cell phones. But I really liked it a lot. It was quite charming and sweet.
We're talking about the film The Waterman. By the way, our John Horn talks with David Oyelowo about his feature directorial debut with The Waterman. Tim, what did you think? Just real quickly, and if we need more time, we'll take it on the other side.
Well, I'll be the bad guy this time because I did not get that. Yes, Spielberg, all of that kind of stuff right there in this film. It's heartfelt, but it's overwrought and overplayed pretty much throughout. And the thing of it is, you have this extremely powerful, dramatic story in the middle of this movie. Rosario Dawson, this father, this little boy. The father is not empathetic to the son. And to me, that's movie enough. That's all the movie I needed. Didn't need the mystical, magical.
We'll come back, talk a little bit more about The Waterman, directed by and including in the cast David Oyelowo. The Waterman is rated PG. It's in wide release in theaters. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. Christy Lemire and Tim Cogshell are critics today. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire. Tim was just telling us his thoughts about the fantasy adventure film The Waterman, starring Lonnie Chavis, Rosario Dawson, and David Oyelowo, who makes his feature directorial debut with the film. Emma Needle writing the screenplay. Tim, so for you, this just didn't work at all.
Well, yeah, when you have this this story, this wonderful, wonderful dramatic story, Rosario Dawson is particularly good in this movie, that's there. And you have these elements that are so right there for you to use, this boy and his father and how they're not getting along and how the father really doesn't understand this very sort of empathetic little boy that he has. All of this other stuff, the mystical, magical stuff that comes to the film, it really just got in the way of what was already a very wonderful sort of dramatic movie about this little boy trying to deal with this thing that's happening with his mother. So didn't need that other stuff.
The Waterman is the film. It's rated PG. And Christy, a quick rebuttal to Tim on this.
I thought that the magical stuff wasn't totally overbearing. I'm sensitive to that kind of thing, and it bugs me. I thought it was just the right balance, but I'm also a sucker for that kind of 80s movie.
All right, The Waterman's rated PG. Our John Horn again interviews David Oyelowo about the film, and he kind of compares it to The Goonies or Stand By Me or E.T. The Waterman is rated PG in wide release. The two-part film The Crime of the Century is on HBO and HBO Max. It's another documentary from the highly prolific Alex Gibney. Christy, tell us about Crime of the Century, please.
So only Alex Gibney could get his arms around the behemoth that is the opioid crisis in America. And he's doing it in two parts, thankfully, because there's just so much here. The first part is all about the development of OxyContin and how there is documented evidence as to how the people at Purdue Pharma knew how addictive it was and did not care and pushed its sales reps to push more onto doctors and to have doctors prescribe higher doses, and how it's, you know, it's totally criminal behavior that they were aware that people were dying, were getting so addicted to pain relief that they were abusing it. And it became, beyond what it was intentionally meant for, this drug. It's meant for, like, cancer patients to relieve their pain at the end of their lives. And it has become, as we know, just a scourge throughout the country. And the second part is more about fentanyl. And so he has, which is even more powerful and is available in a spray form. And he has interviews with doctors, with people who have been drug reps, with people who are investigative reporters. This is also done in tandem with the Washington Post. So we see some of the work that they have done. And what happens over and over again, and it's maddening, it's totally infuriating, is that there will be a federal investigation into these big pharmaceutical companies. And before any actual trial can occur, they'll just settle. They'll settle for like $600 million, which is nothing when the company has made multi billions of dollars on this drug. And they're paying off politicians through campaign donations. And so people on Capitol Hill, like Chris Dodd, who represented Connecticut, where Purdue Pharma was based, they're there to protect them and then get 10 times the amount of campaign donation from this company. So it's just basically the cycle of how this happened. It's not like a thing that just sort of happened. It was actively like put upon this country, placing these drugs out there. And it will open your eyes and make you angry.
The Crime of the Century, a two-part documentary film from documentarian Alex Gibney. It's available on HBO and HBO Max, the HBO streaming platform. The film is unrated. The Indian film The Disciple is now on Netflix. You might have seen our Film Week colleague Justin Chang touting this film in the Los Angeles Times and being critical that Netflix hasn't done more to highlight The Disciple. Tim, tell us about this film, which is written and directed by Chaitanya Tamane.
Our Justin is quite right. It is a lovely, lovely film about this young man who is a disciple of a very important classical Indian music singer. He himself is training to be a singer under this man, and he's working very hard to achieve these goals. While at the same time, it's about the attitudes that people in India, people all over the world, have about these things. So he is a disciple to this singer who's not a very famous man. He's not big in the field, but he's very, very good, and he's very, very respected. And it's funny, we see these young men have these conversations about how, sometimes it's the unknown folks who are actually the better ones, the famous people. They just sort of rest on their laurels. And it's a sort of argument that we had about rock and roll back in the day here in the United States. There's a lot of performance in the film. Indian music, this particular sort of classical Indian music, as opposed to devotional Indian music or pop Indian music, very specific. It's very strange to Western ears, to sort of ragas and thoughts and whatnot, the intervals between the notes. It's sort of a humming, droning kind of sound. But if you let yourself sort of fall into it, it's really quite beautiful. Of course, Ravi Shankar and we know George Harrison fell in love with this sort of music. And this film really sort of explores all of that, along with the idea of what is it that makes you a master of what you do? Is it being popular and famous, or is it simply being a master of what you do?
After reading Justin's piece about this in the Times, I went and looked for it and found it on Netflix. But just as he said, it wasn't highlighted as a new release, even though it was added to Netflix fairly recently, and the film had gotten critical acclaim at a number of prominent festivals. The Disciple, the film from India starring Aditya Modak, written and directed by Chaitanya Tamane. Netflix is where it's available, and The Disciple is unrated. Monster, the crime drama, stars Kelvin Harrison Jr., Jennifer Hudson, and Jeffrey Wright. Anthony Mandler is the director, and it's credited to three screenwriters, Rada Blank, Cole Wiley, and Janice Schaffer. Christy, what do you think of Monster?
So this is a very strange one because this premiered at Sundance in 2018.
Wow.
And yeah, it's just now coming out also on Netflix. It has this incredible cast. It's like Kelvin Harrison Jr., Jennifer Hudson, Jeffrey Wright, John David Washington, Jennifer Ely, A$AP Rocky is in it, and Nas, and Jarrell Jerome. And so it's mostly interesting as a little time capsule of several actors who hadn't quite gotten big yet and were on the verge of exploding into the culture between Kelvin Harrison Jr., John David Washington, and Jarrell Jerome. But the movie itself is this very frustrating courtroom drama. It's based on a YA novel about a 17-year-old living in Harlem, really good kid, has a bright future ahead of him, wants to be a filmmaker, but is in the wrong place at the wrong time and gets caught up in this deadly bodega robbery and gets arrested and is charged with felony murder. And so basically it's procedural as to how the justice system looks at young Black men like him and, you know, witnesses and the whole system sort of, you know, have condemned him before he can even have a trial. And that is an excellent idea to explore. Unfortunately, is all too relevant still and all too true still. But the way this movie is structured is so frustrating because it maintains the structure of the book, which is the main character narrates a whole lot of it, and a lot of it is as if it were a screenplay. And so he is quite often like saying, you know, like stage directions and telling you things you can see with your own eyes without any kind of insight, without any kind of like sardonic twist to it. And there's not a whole lot to these characters, and there are some fine performances here and there, but I just found the whole thing to be an enormous waste of tremendous talent.
Monster is the film. Anthony Mandler, the director. It's unrated, and it's streaming on Netflix. The Swedish sci-fi action film The Unthinkable is directed and co-written by Victor Danell. Tim, tell us about The Unthinkable, please.
Yeah. Crazy Pictures is the collective of these young Swedish filmmakers who write and direct and star in this film. The star of this film is also one of the screenwriters. They're telling several stories here. We start out with this sort of troubled family movie. Abusive father, young teenage son, the mother eventually leaves, the young son gets angry and he leaves. Fast forward 10 years. And we find ourselves in this invasion disaster movie wherein unknown, unseen attackers attack Sweden brutally, destroy these bridges. There's some sort of an odd acid rain sort of thing going on if the rain makes people forget what they're doing. We see all of these astoundingly staged car accidents and helicopter crashes. All of this is going on while that family drama thing that we had been watching at the beginning of the movie, it's still playing itself out in the background. It's fairly intense, a bit overly long as well. And by the end of it, I kind of just wanted it to all be over.
The Unthinkable, Christy.
I was so impressed with the way they made these very elegant and very seamless transitions between genres. Because as Tim describes it so well, it is several different kinds of movie going on at once, but it's all of a piece. And there's some beautiful cinematography here, some incredible editing. Tim referenced this one incredible car crash scene. I mean, this is not a very big budget movie. I don't know how they pull this off because it all looks totally practical and tangible and real. But once things start falling apart in Stockholm, people start forgetting how to do basic things like drive a car. And it's shocking. My jaw dropped open during this whole giant car and helicopter crash scene. And yet at the heart of it is this, you know, much more tender story about a family that has broken apart and a young man who is just straining to find where he belongs. He's this incredible pianist, but he's so alone and he wants to connect with people in the midst of this giant tragedy. So it's a lot of movie at once, but it blends them all together quite beautifully.
The Swedish action sci-fi film The Unthinkable, starring Christopher Nordenroth, who is the co-screenwriter with the director of the film, Victor Danell. It's unrated and available on multiple on-demand platforms, including Amazon, Prime Video, Fandango Now, and iTunes. The documentary The Boy from Medellin features Colombian reggaeton singer J Balvin as he prepares for a 2019 homecoming concert. The film is streaming on Amazon Prime Video, and the director is Matthew Heineman. Christy, please tell us about The Boy from Medellin.
Medellin, as he pronounces Medellin, it in his Colombian, yes, his Colombian accent. I did not know a whole lot about J Balvin prior to this. And this is very much in the same vein of several recent documentaries about Taylor Swift or Billie Eilish or Katy Perry, in which you really spend a lot of time behind the scenes with them, hanging out with family, with friends, and you feel like you, quote unquote, get to know them. What I appreciate about J Balvin is the way he has used his fame, the way he has used his incredible charisma and stage presence and ability to connect with people, to be really candid about the anxiety and the depression that he has suffered. And so for the tremendous performer he is and larger than life, and that's a persona he puts on, that J Balvin persona, Jose is troubled and he will gladly talk about that. At the same time, what's happening while this film is being made, while he's preparing for this concert, there's great turmoil in the streets in Colombia, young people fighting for better healthcare, better education, and there's increasing pressure on him to use his platform, to use his fame to say something about that. And so the film also navigates how he figures out what his voice should be in this. So it's actually not a whole lot of performance. It's not really a concert movie at all. It's more a study of a performer and a man. But I learned a lot about him and came away appreciating all the complexity of him.
All right. The film with the Colombian pronunciation, The Boy from Medellin. The documentary's on Amazon Prime Video. It's rated R. Under Gods, a European fantasy thriller, stars Ned Dennehy and Geza Rorick. The film's written and directed by Chino Moya. Tim, what'd you think of Under Gods, the fantasy thriller?
Striking. Several sort of dystopian stories loosely tied together by characters that overlap in some other themes. And it looks and feels like sort of post-war neorealistic, sort of De Sica, Rossellini, Antonioni kind of thing, Stark. Yet it has these sort of bleak, yet these sort of modernist edges and landscapes. The characters are sort of all detached or obsessed with some aspect of their existence. But it's all underpinned by this sort of horror and brutality that anchors this society together. In modern terms, it's sort of reminiscent of, I don't know, maybe Jodorowsky, Leos Carax, Holy Motors, or something like that. It's a bit of a, you have to sort of work your way through it, but if you allow it to overwhelm you, it's really quite striking.
Under Gods is the film. It's unrated, and it's available in select theaters, and it's available on on-demand platforms, including Fandango Now. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC, and we remind you, you can catch it not just on KPCC or the KPCC app, but you can hear it as a podcast, take it with you, download it to your phone from wherever you get your podcasts. We have more reviews that are coming from our critics Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire, and then coming up later this hour, John Horn with first-time director, but of course well-known actor, David Oyelowo. That's coming up on Film Week, right here on KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Christy Lemire and Tim Cogshell. Our John Horn is standing by. He's going to be talking with David Oyelowo, the director, first time out directing a film, which our critics reviewed earlier. And, of course, very well known for his work as an actor in films. Next up, though, is the European drama About Endlessness. The film was written and directed by Roy Anderson. Christy.
This is very much a Roy Anderson movie. He's not made very many movies, but a lot of them have the same kind of look and vibe and themes. It is about a series of vignettes with people who don't really speak very much and don't have names, don't have backstories, but it's a series of static shots. You will hold a shot and the palette is like so muted and the tone is so understated, but sometimes shocking things happen within that frame and sometimes heartbreaking things happen and sometimes absurdly funny things happen. And it's a series of stories which are about people struggling to connect, struggling to find love, struggling to find friendship, and just not feel so alone and isolated and sad. There is this incredible feeling of melancholy. It's beautifully shot in shades of gray and cream, lots of neutrals. But it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. It's very, very slow. It's also very, very short. It's only like an hour and 17 minutes long. But if you are in the mood for something kind of quiet and pensive that will move you in a subtle way, this will do it.
Christy, that's so ironic. About Endlessness in a film that's an hour and 17 minutes. That's funny.
Right? It's super short.
I love it. The movie's unrated, and you can see it at a couple of the Lemley's Theater. They're Royal in West L.A. and the Playhouse Theaters in Pasadena, also available on demand, including iTunes. Initiation, a horror mystery that's directed and co-written by John Berardo. The film stars Froy Gutierrez. What'd you think of Initiation, Tim?
Well, this is a better than average hack and slash, thinking about more than just body count and gore, although there's plenty of body count and lots of gore. It opens with a potential sexual assault of a young woman at a frat party. Our heroine's brother, a star athlete, looks guilty. He was indeed indicted in something the previous year. And then the body count movie starts. A masked guy, man, person with a knife and a nail gun for some reason, no particular reason that I can think of actually, starts taking people out. But the question is why? And the why is what this movie's thinking about beyond just the body count and the gore.
Initiation, Christy.
What's interesting about this is that the serial killer goes after the fraternity boys. Usually it's the sorority girls who get it, right? They're like in the shower, they're having pillow fights, all the silly things that sorority girls are depicted as doing in horror movies. But this time they go after the guys. I was not particularly happy with who the killer ended up being. The theory that I was working from the whole way, I like my idea better. However, I appreciate that this movie has a lot more on its mind, as Tim said, in terms of exploring, you know, male and female gender roles and expectations of each other and the idea of, you know, what can happen to a young woman when she is branded as being promiscuous and how that can be horrifying in and of itself. So no horror movie ever gets the whole fraternity and sorority scene right, but this is trying to do something thoughtful at least.
Initiation, the film, it's rated R, directed and co-written by John Berardo. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge Drive-In in Hollywood, as well as at home on demand platforms that include Vudu, Google Play, and iTunes. The crime thriller Above Suspicion is directed by Philip Noyce. Chris Girolmo is the screenwriter, and the film stars Emilia Clarke, Jack Houston, and Sophie Lowe. Tim, what do you think of Above Suspicion?
Yeah, and Johnny Knoxville in a dramatic role in this movie. Philip Noyce film. This is Philip Noyce, old Aussie invasion guy from the first Aussie invasion all the way back to the 80s. Dead Calm and Heat Wave and Patriot Games, The Saint.
Great film.
Quiet American, all that stuff. Wonderful. Philip Noyce. This film is most interesting in that it's a true story about the very first FBI agent to commit a crime and be convicted of murder for committing that crime. It opens with a voiceover from the young woman's character, played by Emilia Clarke, doing this Kentucky accent, because all of this took place in Kentucky in the middle 1980s. And the first thing she tells you is that she's dead. And then we work our way back through this movie to figure out how that happened. And this FBI agent did it and why he did it and all of that. It's all interesting stuff, but not fodder for a big old movie like this. It's not enough there to make a movie like this fill in. But, you know, Philip Noyce doing his thing.
Above Suspicion is rated R. You can see it in select theaters. You also have the home option with this. Amazon Prime Video, Vudu, and iTunes have it available for charge on demand, Above Suspicion. The Columnist is a Dutch horror comedy. The film is directed by Ivo van Aert. Don Windhorst is the writer. Christy.
Oh, did I relate to this movie? As a woman on the internet, as a writer on the internet, oh boy, did I relate to this movie. It's about a woman who gets sick and tired of all of the hateful and threatening and misogynistic emails and tweets that she gets from men. It's always from men. And she goes on this revenge spree. Like, she tracks people down through Facebook and through Google, and she goes to people's houses. It's kind of like Promising Young Woman in that way. She like turns the tables and actually like looks men in the eye and forces them to accept what they have said and done and like reckon with it. And the wide variety of responses that she gets when, you know, with a human being looking you in the eye is kind of fascinating. I won't say what all happens, what she does to them, but it's cool and so darkly funny. It is pitch black in its humor. And at the same time, while she's going through all this, she also has this really unexpected romance with this kind of flamboyant writer, this man that she had clashed with on a television appearance. And that relationship is interesting too, while she's also out on the prowl doing her thing. I dug it. It is mean and funny.
Well, and not to get too heavy, Christy, but because you raised this about your personal experience, and I just know from all my women friends who are writers and in public positions like you are, the kinds of misogynistic, vile stuff that they receive. Was this therapeutic for at all for you to see this?
Maybe there's a bit of catharsis in it. I mean, I got death threats from my review of The Dark Knight Rises. I mean, people have told me to go back in the kitchen and make them a sandwich in all kinds of vile ways. So yeah, it was kind of fun to watch her go and do that on behalf of all of us.
The Columnist is the film. It's a horror comedy from the Netherlands. The film is unrated. Katja Ebers stars in the film. Don Windhorst, the screenwriter, and Ivo van Aert, the director of the unrated film. Lemley's Virtual Cinema, as well as other on-demand platforms, Google Play, iTunes, and Fandango Now. Tim, please tell us about the Chinese thriller Cliff Walkers from director Zhang Yimou.
No, the great Zhang Yimou. In the early 1930s, the Imperial Japanese government invaded a good chunk of China, particularly northern China. And they were reportedly very, very, very brutal. The Chinese sent several agents off to Russia, the Soviet Union at the time, to train to become special agents and then embark on these secret missions. All of this is actually true. Not much of what happens in this movie is true. Beautiful sets, 1930s, China, the action sequences are thrilling. But this is big, big, big melodrama. I mean, melodrama with the violins and the tears and the whole thing, man. So you have to sort of overcome all of that to get into the story that this movie is telling. But it is an interesting history, a little bit of which comes to the fore in this film.
Cliff Walkers, four Communist Party special agents on a secret mission. Zhang Yimou, the director of the film. It's unrated. It's in select theaters. Stay tuned. Coming up on Film Week are John Horn with first-time director David Oyelowo. You, of course, know him as an actor. Be talking about his new film, The Waterman, on Film Week.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. You heard earlier in the hour a bit about the new family adventure film, The Waterman. David Oyelowo makes his feature directorial debut and also stars in the film. He sat down with our John Horn to talk about the experience and the tips he learned about sitting in the director's chair.
I hate to define a movie by what it isn't, but what your movie isn't is what studios don't make anymore. These are movies that I grew up on, movies like The Goonies, Gremlins, E.T., Stand By Me. And while you're probably a little bit younger than me, it feels like this film is in some ways paying homage to those kinds of movies.
Yeah, those are literally the films that were on my mind, that were in my childhood, that I was looking for to share with my children and couldn't find, and therefore had to go and revisit with my children. And, you know, as much as you and I loved them growing up, the thing that I think our business, I'm talking about the entertainment industry, doesn't seem to appreciate in not making those films anymore is that they provided such a beautiful opportunity for families to not only enjoy adventure, fantasy, entertainment, but I remember having real conversations with my parents having seen E.T., because it was the first time on screen I had seen a family dealing with the wake of a father leaving his family and a mother having to deal with the prospect of being a single parent and what that meant for the children. I remember with the Goonies, same thing. This group of friends, these kids, were about to all be jettisoned from their homes and their community was going to be decimated before the adventure begins. Stand By Me. I mean, a group of kids going to find a dead body. What an intense thing, you know. But when I was that age, these were things I could entertain, things that, you know, didn't feel completely alien to me. And I think weirdly, we've gone into this place where family film means for small young kids and grown-up films is the award stuff and the more critically whatever stuff. And we've sort of lost these films that were able to thread the needle of satisfying the whole family.
And the other thing that I think your film has in common with those movies is that the child, Gunnar, in your story, has agency. He is controlling the narrative.
Well, that's the job of a film. I think the best films ever made tend to be quite disciplined in staying in the point of view of the protagonist. And I think sometimes because grown-ups are the ones writing the scripts, directing the films, conceiving the story, they can sometimes forget to stick with the protagonist's point of view. But again, those films that you and I just espoused as ones we loved, not only did they stick in the child's point of view, but they didn't talk down to the child.
I think it's often the case that and this isn't a horror movie, but in movies similar to yours, there is always a fear of dying. But in this case, it's Gunnar's fear of his mom's dying, not his own. So this is a look really at grief and processing grief and the powerlessness that anybody has when somebody else is either sick or dying.
As much as it is a fear of losing his mother, it's also exemplary of the fact of how much he loves his mother. And, you know, the sacrificial love he has in his heart towards her, i.e. he is prepared to risk everything because she is his everything in a sense. And that's why for us, it was just so wonderful to have the amazing Rosario Dawson playing the mother, who just so beautifully embodies that light and love, and like so many mothers, being the glue in the family. You know, that's why her character is so nervous about the fact that her husband and her son are not getting on well, because, you know, in her absence, their connection is very frail and fragile.
There's an expression that might have some truth, and it is that a lawyer who represents himself or herself as a fool for a client. And I'm wondering if there's anything similar about an actor directing himself.
There is definitely something a little bit insane, maybe even foolish, about taking on both tasks. But, you know, in all honesty, if I hadn't seen it done beautifully by others, I probably would just accept that it's impossible. Because there are just so many things you are juggling as a director anyway, but to then add being in the film as well is really tantamount to patting your head and rubbing your stomach. But, you know, I sat down with folks like Nate Parker, who had brilliantly done it with Birth of a Nation. I sat down with Mel Gibson. I got great advice from Joel Edgerton, who had done it with The Gift and Boy Erased.
What was the best tip you got?
Well, Joel Edgerton, I think, gave me a really, really practical one, which is do not be the one to say action and cut. That is very, very odd. But the really helpful tip on top of that was make sure if you have a note for your fellow actor who you have a scene with, always leave the scene and go to the monitor, whether you actually watch the monitor or not. The truth of the matter is you probably are opposite that person and thinking, okay, we're going to need to go again, because when I'm purely being an actor, I'm not focusing on the other person's performance in terms of quality. I'm focusing on their performance in terms of being a reciprocal vehicle that is reacting to what they are giving me on the basis of what the character needs and wants out of the scene. But as a director, you literally have to keep an eye on the quality of the performance. And the last thing someone you're acting opposite wants to feel is that their acting is being judged by the character they are sat opposite.
There is a maxim, which probably isn't true, that is, if you're directing for the first time, don't do these things. Don't work with kids. Don't work with animals like wild horses. Don't work with a lot of visual effects. And yet you do all of those things. And I'm wondering, as an actor who has worked with kids, I'm thinking of Queen of Katwe or Come Away, the Peter Pan Neverland reimagining, did you find yourself pretty comfortable being on set with kids because of the films that you had done before?
Yeah, I think if I were literally either coming out of film school or I hadn't been on as many film sets as I have been on, then maybe that would have been ill-advised. But, you know, I have worked with kids, not only as an actor, but as a producer at this point. And visual effects, yes, that was a hurdle to overcome, but I've done films that have that as a part of it, and I've produced. By the time I was doing The Waterman, that was my sixth film as a producer. But also I had a brilliant cinematographer, Matt Lloyd, who was literally just coming off of shooting Spider-Man before we did The Waterman. And then, you know, a great VFX house in the shape of Pixamundo. So, you know, again, folks who made me look far more experienced and better than I am at that particular element.
That's actor-director David Oyelowo talking with KPCC's John Horn about his new film, The Waterman. It's in theaters now. And speaking of John, he'll be hosting while I'm on vacation next week, hosting Film Week. Remember, you can also get Film Week wherever you get your podcasts from KPCC.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.